Europe is complicated. What do you do when the high-profile person in charge of finding high-profile people goes missing? Previously in Europe, borders. And welcome to another episode of Previously in Europe, the podcast where we talk about what happened previously in Europe. This week we're going to discuss many things from further east than often gets covered, I find. So we're going to be discussing some of the Baltics and then some of the Balkans. Things that I often say incorrectly the wrong way around when talking about the other one.
We're going to open the nonsense section with the furthest east that we're going to talk about, China.
Yeah, the China, which I think on this podcast is underrepresented, you know, as in general.
You were to say, and I think on this podcast is in Europe.
Well, I mean, like, you include things further east than most people include in Europe, and people on the Reddit Europe subreddit have told me as such. When I try and post news articles from places in Turkey that are slightly further east than they allow.
Boo.
Yeah, well, you know, it's just, we're removing this article because these events take place in eastern Turkey. They can only take place in western Turkey.
Jesus.
Okay. Sure. Fine. So the head of Interpol has gone missing. As reported by his wife. So his wife has reported him missing to the French authorities because the Interpol is headquartered in Lyon in France. So this makes sense that she would be reporting him. But I find it, you know, baffling that the head of Interpol, like, it required his wife to notify people that no one had heard from him. That nobody in Interpol was like, why hasn't the boss checked in? Yeah, this is he was kind of a contentious figure, and Amnesty International in particular were very upset when he got made head of Interpol, because they were worried that China would effectively use this to, you know, basically say that, like, these people are wanted by Interpol, as the head of Interpol says, when they're actually just Chinese dissidents. But, you know, now he's gone missing. Perhaps Amnesty International has something to do with it. I mean, they don't. He's gone missing in China. He's a, you know, big wig in the Chinese Communist Party. It's probably something else.
I like the idea of just being like, the all the signs initially were there that he was going to go missing. You know, the last couple of weeks, he just had a bunch of maps out, and then he started dressing in a red zoot suit. And listening to a lot of the Rockapella.
Yeah, all the telltale signs that he was going to go missing.
For anyone who didn't follow, that was a "Where is Carmen Sandiego" joke.
I only got it after the zoot suit.
Has anyone checked Cairo, Egypt?
Yeah, Interpol won't comment any further, so I don't think anyone has checked Cairo, Egypt. But yeah, where in the world is the head of Interpol is a question and not a fun, wacky pop culture entry.
I feel like that'd be a darker game. Oh, okay. In this little bit of nonsense section, I'm going to talk about something that is quite kind of nice and gives me a little bit of hope in the world, but also quite nonsensey. Yeah, so I'm going to tell a little story about a small Italian town called, I looked up the pronunciation, Riace. a small town in the very south of Italy that it's been suffering from a problem of depopulation. Basically, Italy, like a lot of Europe, has like the aging population, but I think for Italy, it's more of a emigration problem as well, more so than like other countries like Germany, for example. And this town had basically very drastically been depopulated as more people from like rural communities were heading into major city centers. So the mayor of this city, who's been around for a long time, he was reelected in 2009. He was, as far as I know, he started his mayorship as in the 1990s. The mayor of this town, Domenico Lucano, basically revitalized his town by making the town incredibly welcoming to immigrants. This was like housing first schemes, as well as things like next to complimentary classes to like learn mm-hmm. Italian and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And even I think Calabrian, which was like the very, very specific Italian language spoken there.
Yeah.
Things like that. Yeah. 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 And since then, because of this, there's like the town is like got a quite diverse population. Like there's the native Italians, as well as like large population of Eritreans, Somalians, Nigerians, and Pakistanis.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This made him incredibly unpopular, like any mayor that tries to do anything in Italy, with the mafia.
Uh-huh.
So, really dodgy incidents and run-ins he's had with the mafia include, like, being shot at while in a restaurant, twice while eating out.
Yeah,
and has also had both of his dogs poisoned.
Mm-hmm.
He's always been like a big figurehead in like the Italian left. He criticized Matteo Salvini quite a bit. He's even criticized Renzi as being a little bit too right wing for his tastes.
I don't mean to bring this up again, but if he just watched that TV ad Mario Renzi ran in the last campaign, he would learn that Mario Renzi isn't that bad.
Well, there he is on a bike, I guess. Cycling is good.
Have you heard that Mario Renzi isn't that bad? I haven't.
Here I am driving my family car, losing the approval of my wife and my children. They don't see eye to eye with me anymore on political issues.
It's my goal to bring up that that TV ad at every possible opportunity for the foreseeable future.
Oh God. Yeah. So now, under the Nightmare Coalition that we talked about last week, this is a kind of a follow-up, if you want, this mayor has been arrested. He's been arrested. He's been charged with facilitating a marriage of convenience, is how it's been dubbed. He personally married a Nigerian woman to an Italian man, so that she could get more rights, like become an Italian citizen, legally live and work in Italy and have more rights, and also to prevent her from continuing a life of prostitution in Naples, which she no longer wanted to do. So, yeah, that all that kind of thing happened. And, yeah, he's been arrested for this marriage of convenience thing. The little bit that kind of warms my heart is the town and a lot of people across Italy who know about the situation have taken to the streets about it, which, yay. The town who is now like the town who's like quite largely non-Italian, naturalized Italian people would be probably the fairest way of putting it, have come out of support for him, demanding his release, claiming these are trumped up charges, that what he did is also technically not illegal. We were talking about this off mic, but like, you know, mayors have the ability to marry people in Italy and a lot of other like Southern European countries. That's kind of how like a civil marriage usually works.
Yeah.
Especially like if you want to have a secular wedding. So it's nice that this has happened, and there is a lot of political pressure for his release, but just in case you were worried about the nightmare situation of Italy, I mean, you should be. this is a nice glimmer of hope, and I implore people to read up more about the small city of Riace and the mayor of that town.
Two other fun facts about the mayor is he came third in 2010's World Mayor Competition, which is run by the City Mayors Foundation.
Nice.
He lost to the mayor of Mexico, and to put it in comparison, Riace has like 2,000 inhabitants, and Mexico City has 9 million. So he was supported by more people like than Riace has population.
Winner per capita, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely winner per capita, in that he has more than 100% per capita. And also, he was listed in Fortune Magazine's Greatest World Leaders list. He was number 40.
Nice!
Yeah, right? And that was in 2016. Yeah, so he's, like, prolific as a, like, a symbol of... I guess, like, he's... I guess, like, in the US anyway, he's a good example of, like, what people on the left in America would call sanctuary cities. Like, he effectively is just outwardly trying to ignore his now right-wing government, like, or now, like, super anti-immigrant governments, anti-immigration policies. And I guess he was mayor through a large chunk of, like, Berlusconi time, so it's not...
Yeah, it seems so. Like, the other thing that he's done is that he's, like, let me see if I can find this. Yeah, he's like put up a sign outside the like town limits of like Riace, a town of hospitality. Yeah, like he's very much changed the branding of this town as being like the sanctuary city. It's interesting though because I think he's very much gone rogue. Like Spain, Italy has a lot of like local control built into how their society runs.
Mm-hmm.
For like townships and cities and metropolitan areas, they're called communes in Italy, which is interesting. This is like, I think that might be a remnant of like there was a lot of communists in the government of Italy after World War II that weren't allowed to have any real power, so I guess they got to name what the smallest unit of politics was called. It's very interesting. It's a very heartwarming story in general. He seems to be a good thing. And other fun fact is that his local name, his shorthand name is Mimmo, M-I-M-M-O. And unlike Emmanuel Macron, apparently you can call that to him, call him that to his face.
Oh, man. We're not going to talk about it, but Macron's government. Stability. Yeah.
And the last little thing before we leave, like discussing Italy, because this would be like 2 weeks in a row we've done it. Yeah. And the only reason I felt like we could talk about it today is because like we talked about how weird and shitty Italy is last week. There was a really good discussion in response to our last week's episode in the Previously in Europe Facebook group. And I recommend you guys join that because an Italian listener of ours brought to our attention, or mine particularly, of like a whole bunch of infringements on more like mostly what you would consider women's rights in Italy that's happening under the current Nightmare Coalition. And there's been a lot of attention in the news cycle the last couple of weeks, certainly of Brett Kavanaugh in the States and what that kind of means for things like American abortion rights and stuff like that, long term, big picture, and as well as just being like this very obvious like example of everything feminists talk about when they talk about like systematic power of men and how they can get away with like really terrible shit. I feel like the stuff I was reading about what's happening in Italy, I feel like is not getting the media attention it deserves. So yeah, join the Facebook group, see those articles. They're really, really fascinating. We might come back to that as a larger topic at some point, but I feel like we've talked about Italy quite a bit.
Talking about Italy was depressing me too much.
Yeah, pretty much.
So I had to move on. But revisiting one thing from last week, the results are where, as we said last week, the Macedonian name change referendum, or like referendum on the agreement, proposed agreement of Greece that involved name change.
Don't you want the EU or NATO?
Yeah, right.
That was the question, right?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. And the turnout was in the 30s, like it was very low, but 90% of those people voted in favor of it, but there seemed to be like a successful boycott from the president and the opposition who didn't want this. But effectively the government now has said that they're going to try and move forward to it, like get it through parliament, but they don't have the numbers for the constitutional change that would be needed. They need 2/3 and they're not close. So it's unlikely to go anywhere.
It was an advisory referendum, and it was basically to force a parliamentary majority, which they didn't have, to like, 'cause they needed 2/3 majority to agree to this.
Yeah.
And they thought if they could have like a landslide election, or like a election with like really like favorable results in their like really good results in their favor, they could like force some of the opposition to like come around to their way of thinking.
Yeah.
It's kind of like basically what they were trying to do, but it didn't work.
But in a condolence for the Macedonian government, the former prime minister, Nikola Gruevski, who recently, like this week, lost an appeal against a corruption charge which forced him out of office, which resulted in the elections that swept the current government to power. Part of it was via a wiretap controversy, which I encourage people to look up. It's quite funny. I found that one of the things Gruevski did that was corrupt was putting pressure on the Interior Ministry to buy a very expensive Mercedes for the Prime Minister to be driven around in. And yeah, Gruevski's basically saying, I'm going to appeal this again, but he's probably going to have to do his 2 years in prison now for this. And who doesn't want a luxury bulletproof vehicle? I mean, I wouldn't mind a bulletproof Mercedes drive me around, but maybe I wouldn't risk my my government on it.
Yeah, it was a weird choice, but again, like something that always offers like the context of when talking about Macedonian politics. Wasn't there like at some point last year an attempted coup in Macedonia?
No, wasn't that like, wasn't that Montenegro?
Was that Montenegro? Oh, that might have been Montenegro. All right, ignore what I'm saying. Ignore what I'm saying. I am not entirely sure.
It was Macedonia. I don't remember. No, it was there was a previous one in 2016, I think. But I think you're thinking of Montenegro.
I'm probably thinking of I'm thinking of the Montenegro one. I'm sorry. There was a coup attempt in 2015, which that's still too soon for a coup attempt.
No, but that's not the coup attempt you're thinking of now.
No, it is not.
It's a different coup attempt.
All I'm saying is that a bulletproof car might be like a sound investment in the Balkans.
Oh yeah, no, but you can get a bulletproof car that's not manufactured by Mercedes, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, but is it gonna be any good?
I just okay. Sure. Moving anyway, so I guess this is time to move on to our actual topics.
One of our main topics of the evening is the Latvian parliamentary election. Mm-hmm. This is a part of, if you're new to the show, our No Elections Left Behind policy, where we talk about every Kieran's election. Kieran's policy that he has forced onto Hugh. This podcast is a cooperative. Anyway, yes, the Latvian parliamentary election to vote members into the Latvia had parliamentary elections this year to elect for all 100 seats of the Seima. Latvia, like a lot of other like Nordic countries, if you want to, like a lot of countries that far north, maybe they're not Nordic, but still, is a unicameral system. They only have one house for their politics. There's not like an upper or lower house. It's just the Seima. And then there's like a president who holds like a largely ceremonial position.
Yep.
Anyway, the elections went ahead on the 6th. So yesterday, as of recording, so 2 days ago when this comes out. Mm-hmm. And the results are, there's been some upsets, but kind of some things stay the same, but there's some interesting stuff that I want to talk about when it comes to Latvian politics that I think is quite interesting.
Cool.
Anyway, just to go through the like bare bones facts of the results, is that we have our three main parties, Harmony, which is a like center left to like bit further center left, kind of like center left to left wing kind of party called the Social Democratic Party, better known in short as Harmony.
Or sounds relaxing.
It does sound relaxing, or rather to say like the, you know, Latvian word for Harmony. That's probably their actual name. The other big party is the JKP, the New Conservative Party. Mm-hmm. And there's also the KPVLV, or as its translated name, who owns the state? Yeah.
A question which I don't think the party answers.
It's interesting. It's interesting to have a party that's like the party name is a question. Maybe they're not meant to answer it. I feel like if they had the answer, that would be their party name.
How many elections must a man have before he becomes a man?
Exactly. Anyway, they're the three big parties. They got Harmony got 23 seats. The JKP, the New Conservative Party, got 16, and Who Owns the State also got 16. There's other parties as well who've made it into the same Development 4, which is like a liberal pro-European party, the National Alliance, which are just Nazis. You should really look up their logo if you have like a Google image search in front of you. They're not even trying to hide this shit. They got 13 seats as well. Yeah, right.
I mean, they're a combination of two previous parties, which were called For Fatherland and Freedom. Come on, guys. And All for Latvia! !
God damn it. Anyway, you also have another party, the Union of Greens and Farmers. Which I've been told by Latvian people, are not really like what Western Europe and the United States, as an example, would consider a green party. The other party that got in was Unity. They got 8 seats. There is like a threshold that you have to reach, and it's like a mixed member voting system.
It's like large multi-member constituencies, and then you have party lists per constituency, is my understanding of it. And then it's a multi-round voting system that is like, the first seat goes to whichever party got the most votes, and then the top of their list gets that seat. And then their vote for each successive round is divided by 2 times the number of seats they have plus 1. So you end up with like, after the first time, you end up with a third. So like, a number of parties will start getting seats before you get your next seat. But like, if you got a lot of votes, you'll get multiple seats in that region. I find it less transparent than a like ranked voting system, but that's fine.
So the big kind of upset is the Union of Greens and Farmers. They lost 10 seats, which is like, that is the second biggest loss in the entire thing. New Unity also lost like 15 seats, which like, these are big numbers when you're like only have 100 seats in the total parliament, and like it's split between 7 odd parties, a lot of whom have like very similar seat weights to each other. So it's quite like, that's kind of interesting, and there's definitely a big event there, because going over like the opinion poll stuff, they suddenly dropped basically. Very, very suddenly, and it seems like a lot of their seats went to this Who Owns the State party. There's also been like a reshuffling of the conservative element of Latvian politics. Like, the New Conservative Party is called the New Conservative Party because they are relatively new. I think the last election was their first election, and they didn't get any seats. Now they've like kind of stormed in as being like the joint second biggest party. Because Unity was also like a quite center to center right party, and I think that's where they picked up a lot of their seats. The who owns the state party, or who does the country belong to party, is quite interesting. With a name like that, you can probably guess they initially arrived on the scene as being somewhat anti-establishment. They do have an answer to that question of what the answer should be, which is the people should own it. But they very much think that's not necessarily what's happening at the moment.
As you call their party, the people should own the state. I feel like I don't know. Maybe they've led me in with this questioning tactic, and now I feel like
we wouldn't be talking them. We would not be talking about them as much if they hadn't asked this question.
That's a good point, man. That's a Solid point. So are they anti-establishment kind of populist people, or, well, no, we're not using that term. Are they anti-establishment people?
They are anti-establishment in terms of things. They've had some like interesting policy ideas. Not as like, there's weird things, but mainly they've been involved in a handful of scandals. Where a lot of the like founding members have been been arrested for like insider trading and politically motivated illegal party financing and stuff like that.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, all that great stuff. They are still the interesting thing now is, and apparently this was like one of the first elections to do this, where all these politicians are now going abroad. Because Latvia is one of those countries where you have like the vote for life. And,
oh, I see. Right. Yeah, yeah.
And the Latvian diaspora is like huge. So they are they themselves, the Who Owns the State party, is actually the most popular party amongst the Latvian diaspora. So like
that
if you were
interesting. Yeah.
If you were in Dublin or London or Berlin, chances are you saw these guys campaigning. which I find very interesting. This is the world we live in now, but sure. Yeah, so they're kind of like a big force to reckon because they're like joint second. This is the first election they've ran in, so boof. The other interesting reason why I have to pay attention to them about this is that the party that got the most seats, Harmony, the Social Democratic Party, they've had the most seats since the last election as well. Like they went from 24 seats last election to 23. They lost one this election. But they are purposely kept out of government. From like being like running the coalition. There's usually like a united coalition against them.
Yeah, right, okay, I see. Not the case now.
Well, it might be harder to form that coalition, but there will probably be attempts to do so. They're quite divisive within Latvia themselves. And the only thing they've really had control over to prove like how good they are as a party is they are the party in charge of Riga, the capital. And apparently they've done quite well there, opening schools and playgrounds and revitalized the city in a lot of ways that people are quite proud of and has helped opinion polls. But the reason they are so divisive is because one of the key issues they have and they're not willing to compromise on is they want fairer treatment for Russian Latvians. The Latvian population that is are Russians, are ethnically Russian, speak Russian. These are people who've been left over from the Soviet Union days. When like Stalin was encouraging like every Soviet republic to basically just become a smaller Russia, which you know the native Latvians did not appreciate. Apparently, this has resulted in a big media circus around this party of them being in bed with Russia. That, from what I've seen of a lot of investigative journalism, does not really hold up. Other than the fact that they just think that. We should be fair about like giving passports to the like Russian Latvians and things like that, and we should involve them more in our society. Which is a weirdly divisive issue. Even though apparently like there's lots of studies that have shown that like the Russian population of like the Baltic countries like Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania are like the most politically opposite to like actual native Russians. They often like because they return so often to Russia, they're just like, no, I don't want our country, the country I live in, to become like that. Thank you very much.
Right.
So they're like Harmony are like these big people being like, look, your concerns about them like being like a fifth column within our society are only warranted if you constantly exclude them from the political process.
Like if you include them,
if we like make news, like if we make media and news resources that are in Russian that like don't, you know, tow the Russian political line, like party line, they're probably more likely to be on board.
Yeah, exactly. As opposed, making them actually integrating them, as opposed to giving their only outlet being, you know, actual Russian Federation input.
Yeah, which, like, over the years, there's been improvements on that for all three Baltic countries, but yeah, apparently it's still a very divisive issue, so much so that this party could be, like, excluded for government for exclusively this reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I found that very interesting. But, it'll be interesting to see what coalition forms. It's a very split parliament, but this is normal for Latvia, with only having 100 seats, with a lot of fairly strong parties.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the two interesting things I was trying to find out about this that I wasn't able to was the turnout was bad. It was 54%, 54.5%. We'll give them that. I couldn't quickly find turnout for the previous election, nor the election before that. 59 in 2011, which was two elections previously, and 58 the year before. So yeah, like, the turnout is normally this bad, but like, if your like regular turnout is nearing half the registered voters, that's bad, because that's registered voters as well. That's not even necessarily like people in the diaspora, for instance, who would be hard to count.
I wonder actually if that's coloring it in any way. Like, I can't imagine, are they maybe overestimating the numbers diaspora or something like that, who actually are capable of voting, or I don't know.
Yeah, well, this is people who are registered, I guess, is the estimate they're using. Yeah. But also that on the official like results website, there's no division of where the votes are coming from. It's based, like, the divisions are down to like regions in Latvia. There's no like thing that you got in the Italian elections, for instance, where it's showing this is the number of votes from people who aren't resident. These are the number of absentee ballots. So we don't have that breakdown, which is interesting. But like, based on their campaign practices, we know that they are sufficiently interested. They know they have data that there's enough people voting externally to use it. But I can't get the from the results of this election. I can't find those numbers.
I think it's because unlike, say, France, where they like have fictional kind of like departments for like the French people in Asia, the French people in Africa, things like that. I think Latvia runs in a system of the vote goes to where you lived last.
Which is interesting, because I imagine that actually bolsters
rural areas.
Rural areas more than you'd think. It's interesting, how that ends up working out. Considering it is like a constituency based system, like it's a multi member constituencies, but it's it is divided up, which is curious.
It's also, I just wanted to point out about like the whole, just going back to Harmony and their whole like Russian issue thing. Mm-hmm. I was just looking at the map and I can't believe I didn't really make this connection before. Mm-hmm. Harmony basically got all their seats from Riga, the areas around Riga, and the far east of the country where the Russian minority largely lives.
Yeah, it's as if saying that the Russian minority should be more included enrages rural like ethnic Latvians, and then the rural ethnic Russians are like, that sounds good. Quite funny.
Sign me up.
Yeah, so the last three elections, that was good. I guess I wanted to mention the Eastern Border podcast did a recent episode on Latvian politics in general running up to the election. Which, if you want to dig in further to like some specifics about the goings on of individual parties in the last couple of months, that's probably a more in depth look at it, because it's by a Latvian.
So two Latvian journalists. The host of if you don't know, the Eastern Border podcast is done by a Latvian journalist whose beat is the like former Soviet countries. And then he, in that podcast, interviews a Latvian journalist who does like Latvian politics, like the internal goings on. So it's a very interesting conversation. They go through like basically each party that has a chance of getting into the parliament. This is because they recorded this before the election. It's a very good listen. And the other like issue that I can't find a lot on myself, but they seem to like were kind of hammering home as being like one of the main issues for them, or like something that's kind of happening in Latvia, is actually gay marriage. They were mentioning that like a handful of like senior political figures are gay themselves, and like have gotten married in other EU countries and come back, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And a lot of like Latvia's young population is apparently getting a bit antsy that the topic of gay marriage in Latvia isn't being talked about enough.
Yeah, right. Which is, yeah, reasonable.
Yeah. So, cool. Yeah, Eastern Border, yeah. We recommend that.
Yeah, and, you know, Latvian elections, fun. And some stuff happened, but in a lot of ways, not a lot happened. I don't know.
Yeah, so. Basically, if you voted for the Green, if you voted for the Greens and Agrarian Party last time, you probably voted for who owns the state this time.
Yeah. Yeah, so moving away from the Baltics and moving down south to the Balkans.
Balkans?
Back to the Balkans. We were just talking about Macedonia. So
yeah.
Now we're going to talk about Kosovo and Serbia, which is, you know, just in between. Yeah, so I guess this is about, there's kind of like continuously been news stories about this since, I would say, well, like, you know, perpetually since the breakup of former Yugoslavia. But
which wasn't exactly a singular event either. That kind of dragged on for a bit.
What? No. let's forget the 90s happened for a minute. Yeah, so I guess there's been rumbling since August that there was a potential that there would be talks to have some sort of land swap between Kosovo and Serbia that would be part of an agreement that would have Serbia recognizing Kosovo, which they currently don't, and that would then allow for both of them to start looking into like EU membership. However, this is not like a simple thing, and it is very complicated. I think like the more I read into this, I'm gonna make a pitch to you now that I think that they probably should have a land swap of some description, which is a unpopular opinion in a lot of Kosovo, as I will now go on to say, and unpopular in like a lot of Serbia, namely the place that Serbia want to give to Kosovo. In an event that the New York Times has called peaceful ethnic cleansing.
Oof. I feel like I've heard Richard Spencer talk about that quite a bit.
Yeah, so this is a I would say that's an unfair comparison.
That is an unfair comparison, but that was literally what he called one of his talking points.
Yeah. So actually, interestingly, the argument of that New York Times piece, like it's in the New York Times opinion piece, was that maybe this is like the best solution to like a bad problem, because it is otherwise a stalemate where you have Serbia just basically pretending Kosovo isn't there in a lot of ways. I do sort of agree with that position, because I don't know what the alternative is, but historically and continues to be, the EU is very against this, which is leading, there was a good EU Observer opinion piece during the week that insinuated that Serbia isn't being genuine about considering any sort of land swap. This is them trying to distract the EU, basically, and pressure them into accepting Serbia into the EU no matter what. And this is Kosovo's president trying to distract from potential war crimes he committed and The Hague is looking into.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so basically like there is Northern Kosovo, which isn't actually controlled directly by the Kosovo government. They're like not recognized but de facto governed themselves to a certain extent. And there is a Brussels agreement which is sort of adhered to, which effectively says that you're supposed to partake in the Kosovo elections if you live in northern Kosovo. But Kosovo are supposed to let you have some sort of autonomy. The Kosovo police force are technically supposed to be in charge, but there's supposed to be a Serbian Kosovo national has to be the head of that police force in that region. So, like, effectively, northern Kosovo, the bit that Serbia, in this hypothetical non-existent land swap, would be getting, is a region that is, it's like 90% ethnically Serbian people,
yeah,
who are clearly not happy with being part of Kosovo in the first place.
The big town in this region is Mitrovica, isn't it?
Mm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It's also worth pointing out that this is like, calling it northern Kosovo might kind of, in your head, you might be envisioning like a 50-50 split of Kosovo. It's very far north. It looks like, if I were to hazard a guess, somewhere between 6 and 10% of Kosovo's total land.
So if you imagine Kosovo as like a, you know when you're making meringues?
Yes.
And then you whip it up and then you get, there's a peak. So Kosovo's like that. It's like a blob with a peak on it. And then they want to chop off the peak because the peak is surrounded by Serbia and full of Serbians. And then there's a place in to the east of, on Kosovo's eastern border, like southeastern border, kind of mostly surrounded by Macedonia and Kosovo. That's kind of journeying out into Kosovo, called the Prezno Valley, which is largely ethnic Albanians who are the majority in Kosovo. Presovo. Yeah. And it's like some undefined portion of that would be what they're talking about when they say land swap. It would be northern Macedonia and something in like Kosovo gets some portion of that in return, in an undefined way.
Yeah.
The main argument against this effectively is, well, there are many arguments against it, but the main international geopolitical argument against it now and historically has been, if you let them do this, or if the EU is seen to back any agreement like this, you would have this exact conversation happening in several states in the region. So you'd have the problem of, well, we'll talk about the Bosnia-Herzegovina elections, which happened today as of recording, and the results will be out probably when this podcast goes out. That you have a like ethnically Croatian populace that want to separate up the government further and have like a semi-autonomous Croat region. You have the Serb minority who want to just secede from the country entirely.
Yeah.
So you would effectively have, there was no envisioning from most people who lived through the 90s that if Bosnia and Herzegovina broke up via, there'd be no peaceful breakup of that. And realistically, based on the reaction from people in Kosovo to these rumblings from their president and Serbia, that people would actually agree to this, or that it would go down well with the population. So the idea that you could have a peaceful land swap would be like a domino effect thing. So you would have one peaceful land swap that would then result into lots and lots of regions and minorities saying, well, I want to be part of this country instead of this country. And it would start, the entire region would break up. And effectively the borders that they spent an awful long time establishing wouldn't remain established.
Yeah. Just the entirety of the Western Balkans, particularly like former Yugoslavia, is like a quite ethnically and diverse, like mixed and very diverse piece of land.
Yeah.
The other minority that's kind of being overlooked in all these discussions in Kosovo is the Gorani people, which are... they're a distinct minority group found only within the tiny little southern tip of Kosovo. And yeah, they're kind of like, as far as I know, they are unlike a lot of Kosovo, which is Albanian, they're Slavic. They are Slavic, but also Muslim in the same way the Bosniaks are. So sometimes they've been referred to as Macedonian Muslims, which they've been referred to a lot of different things that aren't really like fair to their, what they are. But and this also extends like a huge part of northwest Macedonia is like Albanian. So it was a lot of southern Montenegro.
Yeah.
And to be fair to the Balkans, like I think a lot of people can, it's super popular in a lot of like image sharing websites like Reddit and stuff like that to like show an ethnic map of the Western Baltics and or Western Balkans and be like, oh, it's crazy. But I think a lot of people forget that the reality of a lot of Europe is like this. Like there's ethnic Italians and like on the border of Italy and Austria. That's like, that's, this is not uncommon in Europe at all.
I think it's very easy to imagine like the idea that, oh, we drew this line on a map and then suddenly everyone separated themselves out onto whichever side of the line they wanted to be on. And they all agree that's fine. And like, that's not really the case. People don't generally like move dramatically when you change like a line on a map. So there's like, if they were part of one contiguous unit for a long time, so it becomes more mixed up than a lot of places, which I think is why you get the term like peaceful ethnic cleansing being thrown around. Because effectively, this is an idea that most people agree that like, well, this probably isn't a great idea. However, your alternative currently is when Serbian government officials get asked at like the UN General Assembly, are you thinking of like, if this agreement went, like what agreement would there have to be for you to recognize Kosovo? And their response is, oh, we recognize Kosovo as a semi-autonomous region of Serbia. And you're like, no, I think, oh no, your intention. Oh, I see.
Oh, I've been duped. I've been lampooned.
Yeah, one of the reasons this is kind of coming up again is that the Trump administration is understandably like, similar with Ukraine, this is clearly an example of Trump doesn't understand why this would be a problem at all and doesn't care. And a lot of people in the Trump administration are effectively just would rather that the Balkans have worked out a different way. So you have people like John Bolton coming out saying that, oh, we'd be all for a land swap in terms of we want this to like get fixed now, and whatever solution is on the table, let's just do it and move on. And like, that's clearly like them not having spent any time looking at this in a lot of ways. But like, the more I read into it, the more it seems like, well, actually, the end goal of this, while short term you can look at, well, this is like, in like you have influence of like the leader of Serbia has like strong ties to Putin, for instance. And this is like another example of potentially Putin trying to like destabilize the region enough that it's a distraction from whatever else he wants to do, or keeping Russia involved as like a, if things end up coming to like big UN votes, Russia has a lot of veto power in the Security Council, etc. But if the end goal of this is that both of them want to join the EU and Serbia would only agree to such a deal if like their EU membership was a guarantee as like an end of it, or there was like a clear end goal. If they want to like move the border, so there's people annoyed now, but like the people in the places you're moving are a majority of which aren't angry about it, and the end goal is to at some point be in like a common travel area. What's the, like, the agreement effectively is like disagreement over who your current national government is in a region that, as we've discussed previously, that those bodies aren't really effective anyway, because you have North Kosovo not being actually under control probably from the Kosovo government. So like, in a lot of ways, the arguments against it seem to be more like, okay, well, you've a vested interest in the region staying exactly as it is now, which a lot of people in the region don't like. So you're saying that therefore they can't agree to change it?
Yeah, I think like a lot of things with Western Balkan politics is there's just a huge amount of mistrust between these countries, between these governments, because like if you look at the maps of... So one of the issues of this land swap idea is that Serbia has been kind of vague about what it would be giving to Kosovo, because theoretically we know what Kosovo would be giving to them, because the region of like northern Kosovo with Mitrovica in it and stuff like that, that is, like you said, an autonomous region that has it has a defined boundary within Kosovo now. Whereas, as far as I understand, the highly like Albanian Kosovar regions within Serbia, like the Prizevo Valley, don't have that currently within Serbia. There isn't exactly defined boundaries.
No, there's no, there's like, even in like rumblings of such a deal, there's been no specifics of like what portion there, like the discussion effectively is some portion of the valley. There's no there's no like on this town and this town but not this town.
Exactly. But like based on map, like these kind of like ethnic maps that you get, which sometimes aren't necessarily super accurate anyway because they're hard things to measure, but like it looks like a pretty fair land swap that would probably result in situations that would be happy to both.
I think that's part, like part of the problem is it's like you're swapping around, like you're having high level governments and who might not, like those regions don't have like a lot of say as to what the like who the president is of their respective countries, especially since until very recently that part of Kosovo was boycotting Kosovo elections largely. You have them making high level decisions of like land where thousands of people live and effectively saying like, you're now part of this country, we said so, which is part of the problem with it, is like and also you have, you know, Kosovo, like it seems that the Kosovo like population isn't actually for this. It's their president in particular, whereas the prime minister and 20,000 people who came out to protest on the 29th of September in the capital against such a deal don't like this idea, as in a like you can't bargain with our like national sovereign land. But again, if you're in the situation where your country can't join the UN because Serbia says so, and Spain doesn't recognize that you're a country because of other problems, and you can't, like, this is like, it's not functioning now in a lot of ways, it's complicated for that reason.
It's, but like you said at the beginning of this, this has been going on for a very long time, bubbling away for quite a bit, and it's likely to not be resolved very soon. So don't expect an update from us next week about the situation.
No, and like it effectively seems that, you know, it probably isn't going to go anywhere. But I think it's interesting because it's a, it's effective, it's showing up a couple of things that are kind of recurring trends, which are the US has now become an unreliable actor in what was previously like a, like there are a number of situations like this around the world of scotch tape held together of like international consensus has agreed on this thing working the way it works sort of now because the US, the EU, or like whoever else is big in the region has buy into it, and now the US foreign policy has like massively shifted and or just become non-existent in a lot of ways. So that's a recurring problem, and then also the issue of the entire region being, you know, ethnically diverse, but now the recent current trends of elections and political maneuvering is to, well, can't we change that? Let's change some stuff up. These borders haven't been here that long, really. maybe it's time to redraw them again. It's like, well, yeah, I don't necessarily disagree with that, but I don't think it's going to be, I don't think it's going to be peaceful. There was a good quote, I think it was in that peaceful ethnic cleansing New York Times article about from a ethnically Serbian guy in the bit of Serbia that would theoretically go to Kosovo. There's this like young guy working in a shop who effectively said, the Serbians haven't historically changed their borders peacefully. I can't imagine they'd start now. I mean, he's not wrong, but maybe the current political structures around Europe and the rest of the world aren't ready for something like this to fall apart, and maybe it's on the verge of doing so, or there being a big shift of some sort. So, I mean, keep an eye on it, I guess.
Yeah, one thing that always, like, there was one thing that always struck me, it was particularly about Crimea, was, like, Merkel's official line on that was that the post-World War II borders must be maintained. That was her, like, her line.
That's her line on this, but about the break of...
Totally, but it's just an interesting way of framing it, being like, I don't think the annexation of Crimea was in any way legitimate, and like reports of what they've been doing to like the ethnic Tatar people in Crimea to like kind of force this idea that it's Russian majority ethnic area. It's worrying, but the idea that that like thing is off the table feels inherently wrong to me. It's like, well, like if these borders become like ridiculous and like no one really wants them anymore, then screw the post-World War II consensus. This needs to change.
Yeah, I understand. I guess I understand that position from a, haven't we stopped forming nation states and we're now like doing a later, like a, I don't know, like late game diplomacy or end game civilization stuff, and we're now forming like larger alliances. Is that it? Like, I guess that's her position, because that's effectively what Germany wants, is they want countries to work out all their differences and join the EU, and then we can all have a multiple levels of government that don't need to shift around because they all sort of work. But I guess this is a case of two places who are somewhat in agreement that it doesn't work the way it is now, which it doesn't, but
it's an interesting way of looking at it.
Yeah, no, it is an interesting way of looking at it. I think the way I come down on it now is basically if everybody can agree that what they actually want to do is join the EU, then why is the EU stop like saying that no, you can't change even a small bit of your border? Like that's an absolute like get it off the table kind of conversation. Whereas I do understand Merkel's position of there's the regional problem of starting this conversation again. But
yeah,
I think it's fine. Just draw a line here, draw a line there.
Yeah, oh no, we've accidentally recreated Greater Serbia. God damn it!
Yeah, there was another good quote. I think it was from a Kosovo government official who wasn't named, which was just everybody with a map and a rifle has gotten too excited. Which is like, I think that's I think basically you've had the problem now is there. He's basically like, he or she is kind of saying, our president has said some things. It has caused people to get in a fervor about, well, if all the lines are on the table, I wanted this little inlet from Montenegro all this time. Why can't we have it?
I feel like I know too many people who fit that description.
Yeah. It'd be fine.
Congrats. Previously in Europe is recorded and produced by Hugh O'Brien and Kieran Dold. If you like the show, please tell your friends about it. That kind of stuff really helps a lot. And if you can't do that, or if you've done that and you want to do something else, review always helps loads. Reviews on Apple Podcasts really help with other people finding the show. But whatever kind of podcatcher you're listening to this on has probably a review function, and I'm sure that helps. If you want to keep in touch and read some interesting articles that get posted by our lovely community of people who listen to the show, then you should join the Facebook group. Previously in Europe, just search for it in the groups section of the search function of Facebook. You know how to use Facebook, it's fine. You can join that, and if you don't look like a bot, we'll let you in and you can have discussions and tell us about what weird stuff is happening in your part of the continent. You can also tell us via Twitter. We are at Prev in Europe, P-R-E-V in Europe. We are also on, email, previously in Europe at gmail.com. We have a website where you can find all the details of the stuff I've just said, previouslyineurope.eu. And lastly, if you're out there and if you are from or currently live in the nation of Bosnia and Herzegovina, can you please, please tell me, before we have to talk about the results of the election, how the government there works? I still don't understand it. Thanks for listening.